to reserve any rebuttal time regarding your case?
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to reserve 3 minutes, please.
Certainly you may, and if the parties are ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court, I'm Victoria Johnson on behalf of the Commonwealth. This is, as you know, a Commonwealth's appeal where the Commonwealth is appealing a order dismissing a case due to speedy trial. And our position is that the trial court made a legal error when it found that the continuances were made on behalf of the trial court, the trial court's own motion, and then concluded that those should be counted against the Commonwealth. We also, kind of in the alternative, argue that the court made an error when it found that the continuances were made on the court's behalf when the record plainly states that they were made on the defendant's behalf. And as a practical matter, of course, as this court has held in an en banc case, when a defense attorney is not present for a scheduled trial date, that requires a continuance as effectively as if the defendant had moved for it himself.
Ms. Johnson, this is Judge Humphreys. Let me ask you this. I think the Virginia Supreme Court, I believe it was in Howard, but I wouldn't swear to that, held that continuances sua sponte by the court are effectively continuances on the part of the Commonwealth. So how do you square that case with the argument you just made?
My understanding is that when the defendant acquiesces in that continuance, then it is not attributable to the Commonwealth.
Don't you have a problem then? Because, I mean, here he's represented by counsel. He has not waived counsel, and of course, waivers have to be knowing, voluntary, and intelligently entered into. So it seems to me where you're represented by counsel and counsel has not been relieved, asking for a continuance, occurring in continuances, is not something defendants are expected or even competent to do if they're not acting pro se. So, I mean, it sounds like you're arguing that because the defendant who has a lawyer sat mute while the Commonwealth explained that his lawyer's absence needed required a continuance, that somehow is the defendant's acquiescence. I could see some presumably unintended consequences flowing from that if we're going to expect defendants to effectively represent themselves whenever their lawyer happens not to be in the courtroom.
Certainly not, Your Honor, and I apologize if my argument was unclear on brief. That is not my position. Instead, it is because the defendant was represented by counsel that it was counsel's duty to object to the continuance if that was counsel's strategy. Here, counsel did not do that. Counsel, he didn't fall off the face of the earth. He was not present in the courtroom, but he could have at any time made an objection, alerted the court to his objection for the continuance. Instead, it appears on this record that, consistent with New York v. Hill, which holds that it is counsel's duty to make tactical decisions, including scheduling trial, continuing trial, and that counsel has the right to waive the speedy trial right, certainly statutory speedy trial right that we have at issue here, that was counsel's job. Now, whether counsel was ineffective for failing to do so is a separate issue. I submit, because I would deal with any ineffective assistance claim that might come down the pike, that it's certainly not unreasonable to seek a continuance when you're having some kind of health problem. So I submit that it was counsel's duty to do that. Counsel did not do that, and therefore the defendant, who is represented by counsel, acquiesced. Counsel acquiesced. Counsel can do that under the statute and under Supreme Court precedent. So that's my answer to that question. And as a practical matter, the case is not going forward on either February 21st or May 25th when counsel was not present. And this court has recognized that in the Jeffries case, the Jefferson case, because if there is just no defense counsel there, the client really has two choices. The client can waive his right to counsel and demand to go forward immediately, or there's going to be a continuance. In this case, the trial court, you know, kind of preempted the first option. The defendant was facing very serious charges. I think it was two counts of possession with intent to distribute, third. So I think that he was facing, a minimum of, 20 years, if I'm recalling the statute right, and a maximum of life. And the trial court said that it wasn't fair to expect this defendant to proceed pro se, especially facing these charges. And although this, you know, I feel like this case has been briefed quite thoroughly, I haven't heard any practical suggestion from the defendant as to how this case was going to proceed otherwise. There was going to be a continuance. And because the court could not go forward. And here I submit that the suggestion that the Commonwealth somehow acted in bad faith by, after the continuance being granted, then asking for a capias for a witness who was missing is an incorrect reading of the record. Here, the Commonwealth never had to face the choice to go forward without the witness, because there was no defense attorney in the courtroom. So the case just was not going to go forward. And, you know, it's not directly in the record, but the Commonwealth had a theory of how to go forward. The Commonwealth could have chosen, if defense counsel had been present and their witness hadn't been present, the Commonwealth could have chosen to try the case right then without that witness, or the Commonwealth could have null-prossed the case. And those are two choices that the Commonwealth clearly has before it, but the Commonwealth just never had to reach that issue because, again, there was no defense counsel there. And, you know, it's also pretty clear on the record that the court who heard the speedy trial motion was well aware for the reasons that defense counsel wasn't there, that it was some kind of health issue. It wasn't, it appears that it was not an unknown circumstance. There was some suggestion at one of the hearings, I believe the May 25th one, when the Commonwealth pointed out, you know, this is the second time defense counsel hasn't come. The Commonwealth would like to move this case along. The court said, well, I'm not going to replace defense counsel without him being present. So I think that the court and the Commonwealth is doing the best they could in this case to move the case forward. But unfortunately, defense counsel had a problem that necessitated a continuance. I think that's pretty much my position. I think I spit that out a little faster than I intended to. But if the court has questions about that, I'm happy to answer them.
I have no questions.
I'm fine.
Thank
you.
Okay. Then I will wait for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hapgood?
Yes, this is Clifford Hapgood. I'm representing Mr. Craig Hibb, the appellee in this case. The speedy trial time period is definitely gone. It started at the arrest of Mr. Craig Hibb on the 16th of June of 16. And the 273 days would have then been March the 17th of 2017. The defense did ask for a continuance when it said it was not ready for trial in October, which added another 68 days. So the time period ran on the 24th of May of 2017.
Perhaps this is Judge Humphreys.
Yes, sir.
I realize you weren't trial counsel initially, and when all this happened, and so where. But it seems to me there's two questions you need to answer in response to Ms. Johnson's arguments. The first is the application of the Supreme Court's decision in Heath versus Commonwealth, which dealt with a situation that I think there. The defendant had asked for a competency evaluation in contemplation of a possible insanity defense, and although no continuance was requested by the defendant, the Supreme Court held that because he clearly could not have gone forward with trial because of the pending competency evaluation, that was basically an implicit request for continuance and chargeable against the defendant. And then the other case that I think you have to deal with is our decision in Wallace versus Commonwealth, where a prosecutor had a family emergency of some sort and was unable to appear. And we held that that is not specifically one of the tolling provisions, the Supreme Court has held that others of like kind can be considered. It's not an exhaustive list that's spelled out in the statute, and that prosecutors aren't fungible, and therefore the fact that the prosecutor had a family emergency justified the tolling provision of the statute. It seems to me if prosecutors aren't fungible and their absence in a medical situation would toll the running of the statute, defense counsel is equally not fungible, and you can't proceed without him or her. And if there's a medical situation, that seems to be the case here, since the record seems to allude to the fact that the counsel was hospitalized at the time for whatever reason. Why, it seems to me, both between Heath and Wallace, that's a pretty high hurdle for you to get over. Here, the trial court could easily have said, well, you know, Wallace applies or Heath applies. There's an implicit the alternative is to force the defendant to go forward without his attorney. He has not waived his right to counsel. So we're between a rock and a hard place. We either throw the case out or we make him try it without an attorney, which is, you know, going to ultimately achieve the same result. So how do we deal with that?
I think Wallace is considerably different because in Wallace, in the record, it has a reason as to why the prosecutor was not there. It was a legitimate reason. In this case, the trial court specifically found that it was not in the record as to why defense counsel was not there, and we have no supporting evidence to understand why. We have an assertion in an email. I think you could assume because the trial counsel was not there on the dates for trial, perhaps it is not strictly a medical problem. And without some other thing to back this up, I don't think we can presume or infer that he actually had a medical problem.
Well, I'm not sure that makes a lot of difference if the defense attorney isn't there at all for any reason, if he just plain overslept and didn't show up for court. Obviously, that might be resulting in a sanction from the court for contempt or something. But how is the Commonwealth to be charged with the responsibility for something like that? I mean, it seems ludicrous to suggest that the policy of the General Assembly enshrined in 19.2-243 is to lay at the Commonwealth's feet lapses by defense counsel.
Well, it would seem to me that this case, with its peculiar facts, you would be in a situation where we have to also understand that the prosecutor was not ready to go, and had defense counsel been there, would have been forced to null prosecute.
How do we know that? I mean, we know he asked for a capias for a witness, but this is an interlocutory appeal. We don't have the full record. I mean, for all we know, that individual was not a necessary witness, and the prosecutor could have gone forward.
Your Honor, he admitted in the October hearing that it was the confidential informant. This is a hand-to-hand buy.
We're speculating about that. I mean, you know, I simply don't know what else the Commonwealth might have in its file. You're obviously much more familiar with it than we are. You know things that are outside of the record we have, but
yes,
we clearly know the Commonwealth, you know, asked for a capias immediately after the first continuance was granted for one of its witnesses. But I mean, I think and it may well be that the Commonwealth could not have proceeded, but I don't know that we know that for a fact based on this record.
Well, it is in the records, Your Honor, that on December the 19th, the same witness was not there, and the Commonwealth could not go forward and ask for continuance, and the judge granted him that continuance. This witness has not appeared three times in 6 months, and I don't see how he could have possibly gone forward without the confidential informant.
Well, counsel, this is Judge Clemens. Was that part of the court's ruling, though? The court's ruling was based entirely on the circumstance of the fact that the defense counsel was not present, wasn't it?
Your Honor, I don't think that's it. If the court's ruling was that there was a due process violation, and the trial court specifically found that the prosecutor was not ready to proceed on either the 21st of February or the 25th of May.
So you're saying that the trial court based its decision on the speedy trial violation in part on the fact that the Commonwealth had a witness for whom it was going to ask for a habeas?
Well, yes, the Commonwealth could not go forward on that, and they basically said that on both occasions. That's why they asked for the habeas.
Well, if that's true, it seems like you're home free, because if that is a necessary witness and he still hasn't appeared for anything, this all may be moot when you finally, if the case ever does go to trial and the necessary witness doesn't show up, you're either going to get a null pros or an acquittal out of it.
Your Honor, I couldn't disagree with that, but I think the question is whether the speedy trial time has run. Is there a justification under the statute or in some other justification? And I think clearly the statute doesn't apply here because of McGinnis. You know, we're in somewhat of an odd situation because the McGinnis case and the Young case, as we've set forth in our brief, are very important to this case. And they were both decided after the hearing in October, McGinnis in December and then Young in March of this year.
Well, it seems to me he stands for the proposition that the policy of the General Assembly with this statute is to basically require the Commonwealth to expeditiously provide a defendant with an opportunity to have their case fairly heard by a jury or by a judge without a jury. But it also, it seems to me, accounts for circumstances beyond the control of any of the parties, as I think Heath says. And, in fact, the statute mentions natural disasters and illnesses of witnesses or witnesses being kept away due to illness and so forth. And as the Supreme Court said, that's a non-exclusive list. So it seems to me at least one argument that could be made, and I'm not sure Ms. Johnson made it, but at least it could be made, is simply that given the way the statute is written with the exceptions, the tolling exceptions that are in there, and the Supreme Court saying it's not an exhaustive list, if it's not something that can be laid at the feet of the Commonwealth, something dilatory or as you put it, bad faith, where the Commonwealth is deliberately trying to prevent the defendant from getting his speedy trial, then I don't see why the policy ought to be interpreted as the General Assembly suggesting that when the defendant's own counsel acts to deprive him of his day in court, that somehow is the responsibility of the Commonwealth, and the Commonwealth should be punished for that, in effect.
Well, I realize that McMinnis says that there, once you're counsel of record, you have counsel, but in actual fact, this counsel has totally abandoned his client. He's had no contact with him since December. He's filed no motions. He's made no objections. He's done absolutely nothing. So even though he is counsel of record and he is technically his counsel, he hasn't done anything. He hasn't been able to, Mr. Craighead has not been able to even contact him in this period of time. He is effectively has abandoned his client. And I don't think that's a situation that the General Assembly was thinking about. I think looking at the exceptions, there are numerous exceptions. They thought that the two would be together at the same place at the same time. I think this is a very, very narrow factual situation, and it can only be applied, I think, in this one case. But he doesn't really have a counsel that is doing anything. He has a non-functioning counsel, I guess you might say.
Counsel, this is Judge Clemens. You would agree that whatever was going on, the trial court never issued a rule against the defense counsel, correct?
No, they did not. Now, Your Honor, I cannot say about this. There is no order that relieves Mr. Deatherage in this case, actually. It's simply that they appointed me, and I sort of would say that Mr. Deatherage could possibly still be counsel of record.
So you have co-counsel, in other words, as far as you might have co-counsel.
To be candid, Your Honor, I'm not sure.
But is there anything else, Mr. Hapgood?
Well, I think we should remember that Mr. Craighead is totally without fault here, and that the way Mr. Dudley proceeded is that he obscured, at best, the fact that he had, failed to produce his witnesses. And if the judge had inquired, and it seems to me the judge at some point should have stopped it, well, maybe even at the first instance, and inquired as to why counsel wasn't there and taken those steps. But it certainly wasn't Mr. Craighead's fault.
Well, Mr. Hapgood, you were a prosecutor for a long time and a very good one, and I know from my own background in that respect, there's been many a time when I've been in court and had a witness issue and was relieved to find out that that my opponent was equally as unprepared as I was and had to ask for a continuance. And I always felt like maybe the governor called and I got a reprieve and I was able to, hopefully get my act cleaned up and be prepared the next time around. So, I mean, that's just the way the ball bounces sometimes, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I've had similar situations, but when I announced ready, I meant I was ready. And Mr. Dudley announced ready and he wasn't. I think that's not something you should do. If the way to handle the situation would have been for Mr. Dudley to say, I don't know where a witness is, I null prosecute the case, and when I can find them, I'll be back. I imagine Your Honor did. I certainly did that.
Thank you, Ms. Hapgood.
Mr. Hapgood, if there's nothing further, then you have almost a minute left. Is there anything you'd like to say to wind up, sir?
The only thing I'd like to say is that in the bad faith situation, the Attorney General has argued that you have to make a specific finding of bad faith. I don't think that's true. Young certainly stands for the proposition, and so does many other cases, that if good faith is found specifically by the trial court, that closes the issue off. But I think if you would direct you to Foster, which basically there was no finding by the trial court one way or the other, and the Court of Appeals went on to make the finding on the facts that were in the record, and I would submit those facts do support bad faith.
Thank you, Mr. Hapgood. Ms. Johnson, are you ready with your rebuttal?
I am, thank you.
Before you get into responding to Mr. Hapgood, I neglected to ask you this in your earlier argument, but there's a second assignment of error here that you didn't address relating to an evidentiary issue with respect to an email between the clerk and, I think, Mr. Deatherage. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize.
Let me ask the question, and then you can try to address it. Can you tell me where you find in the interlocutory appeal statute any authority for us to consider an interlocutory evidentiary issue? The way I read the statute, if it doesn't deal with a speedy trial or a constitutional suppression issue, it could only be raised on direct appeal and not in the form of one of these interlocutory Commonwealth appeals.
I believe that because the evidentiary issue is part and parcel of the speedy trial issue in this case, it's an ancillary issue that can be decided by the court.
Authority for allowing us to decide an ancillary issue like that in this type of an appeal.
Well, Your Honor, the Commonwealth Appeal Statute, even when read strictly against the Commonwealth, as you know it is, doesn't state that no evidentiary issues can be heard. This court has made that determination in cases involving the other subsection, the Massey case, which, as I recall, the court's quite familiar with. But in the Massey case and that line of cases, there's no jurisdiction when a suppression issue is decided on an evidentiary rule rather than a constitutional rule because of the specific wording of the statute. Here, however, the statute gives jurisdiction to the court to hear any statutory speedy trial claim, specifically under the Virginia statute, and the evidentiary issue is included with that. I will also say that that second issue is not dispositive of the speedy trial claim. Even with the 37 days between April 18th and May 25th, as that email relates to the April 18th rescheduling, the Commonwealth would still be well within its time. And for the reasons stated on my brief, I don't intend to abandon that. The Commonwealth believes that it was not hearsay and that the trial court was certainly not required to not take evidence at the speedy trial hearing. Responding very briefly to Mr. Hapgood's argument, I submit that, again, the suggestion that the Commonwealth obscured at best the fact that the Commonwealth was not ready to proceed is not a fair reading of the record. The Commonwealth recognized that there was no defense counsel present, and therefore the case would not be going forward. Rather than obscure its witness problem, it specifically addressed it with the court. The court could have, the court that was actually hearing that motion at the time could have addressed that issue if it believes the Commonwealth was acting in bad faith. And I stand on my argument in brief that there must be a specific finding of bad faith made by a fact finder. That's a factual finding. Furthermore, I agree with the court's earlier characterization of both Heath and Wallace. And, you know, the speedy trial statute is not designed to lay failures of defense counsel at the feet of the Commonwealth and penalize the Commonwealth. Speedy trial has a extreme penalty, and here there is no evidence that the Commonwealth was dilatory or acted in bad faith. The evidence is that defense counsel, for whatever reason, just did not come to court that day. If there's any questions, I'm happy to address them.
No questions. Thank you.
I'm good.
Not hearing any, Ms. Johnson, then... thank you. We will conclude this proceeding. Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Hapgood. And we will, this case is submitted to the court, and I hope both of you have a very nice spring and summer. Thank you.
It was good to talk to you.
Thank you very much.